From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It didn't have a big role in that decision. There are limits on that already. And as I've talked to my former colleagues, they say that a lot of what you do anyway is mobbed with consulting rather than direct lobbying.
Is Senator Lott resigning in order to dodge a new ethics law that requires him to wait 2 years before becoming a paid Capitol Hill lobbyist? Then Abu Dhabi becomes Citigroup's largest shareholder with a $7.5 billion investment. The bailout comes amidst the subprime mortgage crisis and record-high oil prices. And we'll take a look at how the mortgage crisis is affecting homeowners. African Americans and Latinos were more than three times as likely as whites to have a high-cost loan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Bush wrapped up a three-day Middle East summit Wednesday with a pledge to increase the U.S. role in future peace talks. Bush spoke at the White House after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
It's very important for the international community to support these two leaders during the bilateral negotiations that will take place. And one thing I've assured both gentlemen is that the United States will be actively engaged in the process, that we will use our power to help you as you come up with the necessary decisions to lay out a Palestinian state that will live side by side in peace with Israel.
The Annapolis summit launches a new round of talks between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. In an interview with an Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says he will seek a two-state settlement to avoid an apartheid-like dilemma. Olmert said, quote, "If the day comes when the two-state solution collapses and we face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, then as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished." Olmert has yet to accept a longstanding Arab League offer for a two-state agreement on Israel's internationally recognized borders. Arab League Secretary General Amr Moussa called on Israel to accept the deal.
There is a message. Of course, there is a message in our presence here that we mean business. We are ready for peace if you are ready for peace. We are ready to shoulder all our obligations and responsibilities as Arab countries, including normalization. But in the right context, and when we are convinced that Israel is serious, because until this moment we are not convinced.
The Bush administration appears to be focusing efforts on shaping the Palestinian security forces. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appointed retired Marine General James Jones to coordinate security arrangements in the occupied territories. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, dozens of people were arrested when Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's security forces raided a funeral in the city of Hebron. The victim was killed in protests to the Annapolis talks. Funeral goers threw rocks at police, who in turn opened fire to disperse the crowd. In Ramallah, a group of Palestinian journalists rallied against a series of police raids. Al Arabiya correspondent Khaled Al Qasim criticized Abbas's forces.
I do believe that all journalists agree with having law and order, but also all journalists support freedom of news coverage. What happened yesterday was crossing the red line by the security system, which dealt with protesters and journalists.
In Iraq, family members of an exiled Iraqi journalist have publicly emerged to discount his claim that Shia assassins took their lives. The journalist, Dia Al-Khawaz, said this week gunmen killed 11 relatives in his family home. In an appearance on Iraqi television, several family members suggested Khawaz invented the story for political reasons. Former President Bill Clinton is under scrutiny for claiming he opposed the Iraq war from the beginning. Clinton made the claim Tuesday while campaigning for his wife, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, in Iowa. But a look at Clinton's public statements from 2002 on reveal he never unequivocally opposed the war and at times voiced nuanced approval. In March of 2003, Clinton criticized France for opposing the invasion and defended British Prime Minister Tony Blair for taking part. Meanwhile, a former senior administration official is now claiming White House officials personally briefed Clinton in the lead-up to the war and that Clinton voiced his support. The official, Hillary Mann Leverett, is the former White House director of Persian Gulf Affairs. She says she was shocked and astonished at Clinton's claim to oppose the war. Leverett says former administration official Elliot Abrams emerged from one pre-war meeting glowing after Clinton promised he would publicly support an Iraq invasion. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says he's cut off ties with Colombia as long as his counterpart Alvaro Uribe remains head of state. Relations soured last week when Uribe ended Chavez's involvement in hostage talks with the Colombian rebels. Uribe says Chavez ignored his demands that he not contact the Colombian military directly. On Wednesday, Chavez accused Uribe of bare-faced lies.
Por eso lo digo ante el mundo. Lo digo ante el mundo.
That's why I said to the world what I said to the world. While Uribe is the president of Colombia, I won't have any kind of relationship with him or the country. I can't. I can't because of dignity.
President Chavez went on to criticize Uribe's close ties to the United States, calling him, quote, a pawn of the empire. Earlier in the day, Uribe appeared to address the dispute without mentioning Chavez by name.
Los jefes de Estado tienen que pensar.
Heads of state have to think not about their own grudges, not about their own vanities, but in the primary need of respecting the people who they represent.
Venezuela has withdrawn its ambassador to Colombia. In Argentina, an incoming lawmaker is set to make history when she takes office next week. 28-year-old Victoria Donda will join Congress as the first member born to political prisoners during Argentina's so-called dirty war. Donda's parents were disappeared shortly after her birth in Argentina's most infamous torture center, ESMA. They'd been arrested for their involvement in leftist political groups. Donda only discovered her past 4 years ago with the help of the victims' rights group, Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo.
For me, more than feeling pride, I feel a big responsibility in representing the grandmothers. Being a recovered granddaughter is being the living result of the struggles of the grandmothers. On December 5th, I'm going to assume office with my father and mother present, but also with a bunch of elderly women waiting for me to do the right thing.
Victoria Donda was speaking right outside the ESMA prison where she was born. She's one of an estimated 400 people born to women political prisoners in Argentina. In Bolivia, opposition groups staged a general strike Wednesday in 6 of Bolivia's 9 provinces. At issue are several government-backed constitutional changes opposed by oil-rich areas. Bolivian President Evo Morales says the plans will give Bolivia's indigenous and poor communities a greater voice in running the country. The proposals will go before a national referendum in the coming months. Speaking from the presidential palace in La Paz, Morales urged his opponents to cooperate with his plans.
I hope that tomorrow morning these 5 governors are here to have a dialogue. I hope that in 5 or 9 of our departments that we can lay down new social policies together for Bolivia, because this is a government for all Bolivians, not a government for just one sector of them, as some of our companions have said.
President Morales made the call as he approved a law establishing a guaranteed pension for Bolivia's elderly. Oil revenues from Bolivia's richer provinces will fund the monthly stipend. In Saudi Arabia, a lawyer for a gang rape victim sentenced to prison has filed a lawsuit against the Saudi judiciary for revoking his license and defaming his client. Abdulrahman Al-Lahm lost his license after a Saudi court sentenced the woman to 6 months in jail and 200 lashes. The woman was kidnapped and gang raped by at least 7 men. She was convicted of violating Sharia law on contact between men and women. A Saudi court upheld the ruling last week. Back in the United States, Republican presidential hopeful Rudy Giuliani is facing new questions over hundreds of thousands of dollars in questionable billing expenses during his time as mayor of New York City. The Politico newspaper is reporting Giuliani billed several obscure agencies for costs related to his visits to the Hamptons, where he began his affair with his future wife, Judith Nathan. Hotel, gas, and other expenses were charged to city agencies tasked with aiding the disabled, providing public defenders, and regulating loft apartments. Giuliani's campaign denies he tried to hide the expenses. A government agency has reversed 7 rulings denying endangered species protection after a probe found evidence of political interference from a former senior Interior Department official. Julie McDonald, a former deputy assistant secretary overseeing the Fish and Wildlife Service, was found to have pressured agency scientists to alter their findings. McDonald stepped down last May. In addition to pressuring scientists, she was also found to have leaked agency information to industry groups. And it's curtains up on Broadway. Broadway stagehands and theater producers have reached an agreement after a more than two-week strike. Shows will resume this evening. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. After Senate Minority Whip Trent Lott announced his resignation this week, it was widely speculated the Mississippi Republican was quitting in order to avoid new Senate ethics standards that take effect next year. The new rules require senators to wait 2 years instead of one before becoming paid Capitol Hill lobbyists. At a press conference to announce his resignation, Lott was asked about the new law.
What role did the new law that says you can't lobby as of January 1st, 2008, for 2 years if you were to resign by then, have in your decision to resign now?
It didn't have a big role in that decision. There are limits on that already. And as I've talked to my former colleagues, they say that a lot of what you do anyway is involved with consulting rather than direct lobbying. But a lot of what affected the timing here was, you remember, Trish and I had planned on retiring in 2006, and we made it clear. And I struggled with that decision and made the announcement right here that I decided I had to run again because the people I love the most in the world were struggling so much with Katrina. We wanted to, we just had work to do.
Senator, I understand there's a rule in the Senate that if you're negotiating with a future employer that you must register with the Ethics Committee. Have you been down to that committee yet?
Well, I have not yet, but I'm not really involved in negotiations. I've tried to stay away from that. There are some opportunities out there that I want to be able to consider. But I have nothing that we've agreed to or lined up, and I want to look at all of it. Things that I've wanted to do for years hadn't been able to do, and we'll see what they are. I might even want to come back and affiliate with a law firm, but I don't know. I don't have any commitments lined up.
One of the opportunities that Trent Lott is reportedly considering is a partnership with his former colleague John Breaux, the former Democratic senator from Louisiana. Lott's son, Chester Lott, told reporters his father is considering teaming up with Breaux, who announced yesterday that he's leaving the Washington lobbying firm Patton Boggs to form his own company.
Whether or not Lott takes the job, speculation is high as resignation after 35 years in Congress was time to avoid the new ethics rules. The Christian Science Monitor reports it's rare for a U.S. senator to resign during a term of office for reasons other than health, scandal, or quest for higher public office. It's happened only twice since World War II. Since 1998, about 43% of lawmakers who left office have become lobbyists, according to a 2005 report by Public Citizens Congress Watch. In the Senate, half of eligible departing members become lobbyists. Sarah Diffendach is the vice president for legislative affairs at Common Cause. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Sarah. Talk about this new ethics law.
Well, in about 1 month, there's going to be an extension of the prohibition of contacting your fellow colleagues in the House and the Senate from 1 year to 2 years, and that'll take effect January 1st in 2008. So when a senator so suddenly makes a decision to quit and it becomes, and it's so immediate, and you've got 1 month between, the time that happens and the time these rules change, it does make you kind of scratch your head and wonder what is going on here. It could mean as much as, $1 million. I think people are saying that someone as high up as Senator Lott, if he became a lobbyist, could, make a seven-figure income. So this could be a $1 million decision for the senator.
He opposed the ethics law that he will now avoid by leaving by December 31st?
Yes.
At the same time, a couple of days later, there was the indictment of a prominent attorney, Richard Dickey Scruggs, who is the brother-in-law of Senator Trent Lott, who was indicted apparently on charges of attempting to bribe a judge in Mississippi. Were you surprised by that announcement right so soon after Trent Lott's announcement?
Well, sometimes these things just, they come together. I don't know that they're necessarily would be linked. But, you know, you never know. When someone's been in office for 36 years, he served in the House and the Senate, and then all of a sudden, truly all of a sudden, just I'm out and I'm out now. He does open himself up to all kinds of speculation.
Well, let's talk about the significance of not only Senator Trent Lott leaving, but the Senate Minority Whip. What deal did he make with the Republicans? He lobbied very hard for this number two position in the Republican Party in the Senate.
I really don't know how he's been dealing with his colleagues. I mean, they cannot be pleased at this. There's six senators that are retiring. They're going to have to defend more seats in the election. They can't be very pleased with him, especially he just won re-election in 2006, hasn't even filled, you know, one Congress. Leaving in the middle of a Congress, then setting off an entire fight for his position, which is never pretty in the Senate, I can't imagine they're pleased with him.
Let me ask you about Billy Towson, these other examples, the Louisiana congressman who was the key man, the point man on the Medicare bill, the Medicare prescription drug law. Then
exactly.
Quitting, then leaving and becoming the head of pharma. The issue of not only doing that, that's the pharmaceutical research and manufacturers in America, but the negotiation that takes place, when does that take place to start talking to the lobbying firm?
Right. I mean, what Representative Towson did was just appalling. He was negotiating with pharma, a trade association, for a multi-million dollar contract, one of the biggest ever, while the pharma bill, the bill that was going to regulate pharmaceuticals and prescription drug prices, was in his committee that he chaired. So he's doing the business of the company that he's in line for a job for. I mean, it is just appalling. This is a public trust. Representatives are supposed to be working for the public interest. And clearly, he was working for his own interest and the pharmaceutical industry interest, and he was the point guy in the House to make it happen for the pharmaceuticals. It was appalling.
Now, with the new ethics law, what would it do in terms of restrictions on being able even to negotiate a new job in once you leave office?
Right. Actually, I think the better reform, or even a bigger reform than having expanded the, quote, revolving door or the cooling off period between the time you leave and you can lobby, is the one that now says that any member of Congress who is leaving and begins negotiating with anybody has to, within 3 days, disclose to either the House or the Senate that they're in negotiations with these people. And if it's a conflict of interest with whatever is in their committee or what work they're working on, they have to recuse themselves. But even beyond that, they're actually prohibited from negotiating with a firm to be a lobbyist while they are in the House or the Senate. They just simply can't do that, which would have stopped, well, theoretically, would have stopped Representative Towson from doing what he did.
We're talking to Sarah Dufendack. I want to go back to the clip that we just played. It was from Senator Trent Lott's news conference when he announced his resignation. And I want to double check, Sarah, this was a surprise to Republicans as well, wasn't it? To many of them,
yes.
At least.
Yes, yes.
So let's listen carefully when he was asked about this issue of becoming a lobbyist and negotiating as he's a senator.
Right.
What role did the new law that says you can't lobby as of January 1st, 2008, for 2 years if you were to resign by then, have in your decision to resign now?
It didn't have a big role in that decision. There are limits on that already. And as I've talked to my former colleagues, they say that a lot of what you do anyway is involved with consulting rather than direct lobbying. But a lot of what affected the timing here was, you remember, Trish and I had planned on retiring in 2006, and we made it clear. And I struggled with that decision and made the announcement right here that I decided I had to run again because the people I love the most in the world were struggling so much with Katrina. We wanted to, we just had work to do.
Senator, I understand there's a rule in the Senate that if you're negotiating with a future employer that you must register with the Ethics Committee. Have you been down to that committee yet?
Well, I have not yet, but I'm not really involved in negotiations. I've tried to stay away from that. There are some opportunities out there that I want to be able to consider, but I have nothing that we've agreed to or lined up, and I want to look at all of it. You know, it's things that I've wanted to do for years, hadn't been able to do, and we'll see what they are. I might even want to come back and affiliate with a law firm, but I don't know. I don't have any commitments lined up.
One of the things he says, Senator Sentlot says, Sarah Diefendach, is consulting, lobbying. What's the difference?
Well, it's strictly lobbying would mean contact with his former members of the House and the Senate, but we all know that lobbying really is also a lot of strategic planning. How does it work? You know, what is the process? It is a tricky line between laying out an entire lobby plan and procedure and actually picking up the phone or going over to the Senate and speaking with your colleagues. I mean, it is a fuzzy line, and I think he's, you know, members have to be very careful about not stepping over that line.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sarah Diefendach, Vice President for Legislative Affairs at Common Cause. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back from our break, we'll play an excerpt of the Republican debate last night, a particularly fierce interchange between the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, and Arizona Senator John McCain. Stay with us.
Backed by the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. Who rob life of its quality, who render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and dragons, champions of freedom. Cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament, the only response to the deification of tyranny.
Bruce Coburn here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, his song Call It Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan.
On Wednesday night, CNN and YouTube hosted a Republican debate in St. Petersburg, Florida. It was moderated by CNN's Anderson Coop. One of the most heated moments came after a YouTube user asked a question about waterboarding and torture.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm Andrew, and I'm a college student from Seattle, Washington. Recently, Senator McCain has come out strongly against using waterboarding as an instrument of interrogation. My question for the rest of you is, considering that Mr. McCain is the only one with any first-hand knowledge on the subject, how can those of you sharing the stage with him disagree with his position?
Governor Romney?
Well, he certainly is an expert, and I certainly would want to get his counsel on a matter of this nature, but I do not believe that as a presidential candidate, it is wise for us to describe precisely what techniques we will use in interrogating people. I oppose torture. I would not be in favor of torture in any way, shape, or form.
Is waterboarding torture?
And as I just said, as a presidential candidate, I don't think it's wise for us to describe specifically which measures we would and would not use. And that is something which I would want to receive the counsel, not only of Senator McCain, but of a lot of other people. And there are people who for many, many years, get the information we need to make sure that we protect our country. And by the way, I want to make sure these folks are kept at Guantanamo. I don't want the people that are carrying out attacks in this country to be brought into our jail system and to be given legal representation in this country. I want to make sure that what happened to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed happens to other people who are terrorists. He was captured. He was the so-called mastermind of the 9/11 tragedy. And he turned to his captors and he said, I'll see you in New York with my lawyers. I presume ACLU lawyers. So that's not what happened. He went to Guantanamo and he met GIs and CIA interrogators, and that's just exactly how it ought to be.
Senator McCain, there are reports Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded.
Well, Governor, I'm astonished that you haven't found out what waterboarding is.
I know what waterboarding is, Senator.
Then I am astonished that you would think such a torture would be inflicted on anyone in our who we are held captive, and anyone could believe that that's not torture. It's in violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's in violation of existing law. And Governor, let me tell you, if we're going to get the high ground in this world and we're going to be America that we have cherished and loved for more than 200 years, we're not going to torture people. We're not going to do what Pol Pot did. We're not going to do what's being done to Burmese monks as we speak. And I suggest that you talk to retired military officers and active duty military officers like Colin Powell and others. And how in the world anybody could think that that kind of thing could be inflicted by Americans on people who are held in our custody is absolutely beyond me.
Governor Romney, 30 seconds to respond, please.
Senator McCain, I appreciate your strong response, and you have the credentials upon which to make that response. I did not say, and I do not say that I'm in favor of torture. I am not. I'm not going to specify the specific means of what is and what is not torture so that the people that we capture will know what things we're able to do and what things we're not able to do. I get that advice from Kofor Black, who is a person who was responsible for counterterrorism in the CIA for some 35 years. I get that advice by talking to former generals in our military. And I don't believe it's appropriate for me as a presidential candidate to lay out all of the issues one by one. Fine. Get questioned one by one. Is this torture? Is that torture?
Senator McCain,
so that's something which I'm going to take your and other people's counsel on.
Senator McCain, 30 seconds to respond.
Well, then you would have to advocate that we withdraw from the Geneva Conventions, which were for the treatment of people who were held prisoner, whether they be illegal combatants or regular prisoners of war, because it's clearly the definition of torture. It's in violation of laws we have passed. And again, I would hope that we would understand, my friends, that life is not 24 and Jack Bauer.
John McCain and Mitt Romney going at it in the Republican presidential debate that took place last night in St. Petersburg, Florida. It was sponsored by CNN and YouTube. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the Gulf Arab Emirate of Abu Dhabi bought a $7.5 billion stake in Citigroup, America's largest bank, on Tuesday. Abu Dhabi is now Citigroup's largest shareholder, surpassing Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who bought his shares during the mortgage crisis in 1991. As the credit crisis in the U.S. worsens and the price of oil hovers close to $100 a barrel, the injection of capital from oil-rich Gulf states is seen as a bailout of banks in trouble. New York Senator Charles Schumer welcomed the Citigroup transaction, saying it will, quote, help preserve New York's status as the world's financial center. Last year, Schumer was staunchly opposed to the takeover of U.S. port operations by a company from Dubai. The declining U.S. dollar came up at the OPEC meeting in Saudi Arabia earlier this month. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called the dollar, quote, a worthless piece of paper. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said the dollar was in free fall and that OPEC should stop trading oil in dollars. He also warned against a possible U.S. attack on Iran.
Somebody was asking me a few days ago in Santiago de Chile about the threats to Iran and Venezuela, and I said, well, if the United States is crazy enough to invade Iran or aggress Venezuela once again, then the price of a barrel of oil will not be $100, but maybe $200. We need stability. We need peace.
But it's not just Iranian and Venezuelan leaders who are noticing the declining power of the dollar. The November 17th edition of The Economist warned that the United States, quote, may well be heading for recession. Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, former president of Harvard, also indicated a recession is likely in the Financial Times article on Monday. To discuss the state of the U.S. economy today, we're joined by two guests. Nouriel Roubini is with us. He's a professor of economics at New York University, an economic advisor under the Clinton administration, and maintains the widely read Global Economics Monitor website. He was among the first economists to predict the housing slump and now warns a severe U.S. recession is, quote, inevitable. Michael Clare is with us as well. He is the professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, author of a number of books, including Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America. America's growing dependency on imported petroleum. His latest article in The Nation is called Beyond the Age of Petroleum. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Michael Clare, let's begin with you. The declining dollar, Abu Dhabi getting now 4% of Citibank.
Well, you know, oil and everything else is so closely linked. And one thing that's happened in the past year is that there's been a huge increase in demand for imported oil, some of that coming from the United States because we haven't been able to curb our demand, a huge increase in demand from China and India. They pay for that in dollars. As a result, the Middle Eastern oil countries have accumulated a massive, a colossal hoard of petrodollars. They are, as you've been saying, diminishing in value. These countries are trying to unload their hoard of dollars by buying pricey investments like Citibank and a whole host of other things, and to try to use that to get a real property as distinct from hordes of petrodollars of declining value.
And the degree of control now that Abu Dhabi might have over Citibank?
Well, that's hard for me to say. The financial pages have reported they have begun to use that influence to determine the control of the company and to determine policy. This is not my area of expertise, but I get the sense that the dominant oil countries, Russia, Venezuela, the Middle Eastern countries, increasingly are using their oil wealth to shape international politics. And we've certainly seen that in Venezuela and Russia. And here we're seeing it with economic power in Abu Dhabi.
Professor Roubini, your response to this.
Certainly, it's a very difficult moment for the U.S. economy. We are on the verge, I view, of a recession because we have now the worst housing crisis and recession in U.S. history. We have now these oil prices closer to $100 a barrel. We have a severe credit crunch now in the economy. And the U.S. consumer is on the ropes because it has negative savings and is debt burden. And on top of it now, we have these problems coming from abroad, from the financing of our very large current account deficit. So this is a very difficult moment.
Professor, the Citicorp's crisis obviously developed as it began continually restating the amount of losses that it was incurring as a result of the subprime crisis. Your reaction to these enormous restatements, not only of Citicorp, but of Merrill Lynch, of some of these major, major American financial institutions?
Yes, so far these financial institutions have acknowledged only $50 billion of losses, but a variety of analysts in the private sector have already suggested that subprime losses alone are going to be something like of the order of $300 to $400 billion. And on top of it, now you have significant delinquencies in near prime and prime, and soon enough, auto loans and credit cards and commercial real estate are going to go into default, and soon enough, even corporate sector firms are going to default. Therefore, a wide estimate of what these losses might eventually be is closer to $1 trillion, I would say. So we're very, very far from acknowledging, and these firms are catching up in admitting the size of the losses.
And in terms of how could they be so off in their estimation of their exposure. Do you suspect, as with happened with the Enron situation and WorldCom a few years ago, that there's actually been some illegal activity going on in terms of how they have been maintaining their financial records in regards to some of these exposures?
I don't know about illegal activity, but certainly there was a whole system of reckless and predatory lending in the situation of subprime mortgages, and they lend aggressively to people who could not afford, and now the default rates on these subprime mortgages are going through the roof. Therefore, some of these losses were unexpected, and some of it was also that until now they were essentially not marking to market, but marking to a theoretical model, to a fake rating, the value of these assets, since the rating agencies were also part of this scheme of essentially providing very high ratings on packages of mortgages that were actually worth much less. And therefore, now they're forced now by new regulation also to recognize the fact that these things are not worth 100 cents on the dollar, but 90 or 80 or 70 or even less.
And how oil plays into this?
Oil plays into this in the sense that we are, first of all, an oil importer country. And in the last few U.S. recessions, 73, 74, 79, 1990, a major oil shock was one of the important causes of a recession. This time around, again, we have oil gone from before the Iraq war, $30 per barrel, to now closer to $100 per barrel. And secondly, of course, from the financing point of view, as was pointed out by the other author, the petrodollars are being recycled. And until recently, these countries were happy to hold just low-yielding U.S. T-bills at 3, 4, 5%. Now they're realizing that if they have to finance the United States, they'd rather buy our own kind of gems and assets, equity. Therefore, there was lastly this conflict on Dubai ports, essentially taking control of the U.S. ports. This time around, you have now Dubai buying, Abu Dhabi buying a fraction of Citigroup.
You don't have as much attention being paid to this, to the buying of Citigroup. By the way, Citigroup, the possibility of something between 17,000 and 45,000 job layoffs in the next months.
Yes, you know, Citigroup has massive losses, and they're going to fire a very, very large number of people across the world. In the case of this investment, we have to consider the fact it's only a minority investment. So they don't have a board seat, they don't have a significant control. When Dubai Port wanted to buy the U.S. ports, would have been full control of that particular kind of institution. So it's a minority investment. It certainly gives some influence for Abu Dhabi for within the business of Citigroup.
Michael Clare, I'd like to ask you, going back to the oil situation, clearly there have been world oil crises in the past in terms of the run-up of prices, but there seems, it appears to me, somewhat of a distinction this time in that the major countries with the hugest, largest oil reserves, Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, are also countries now where there are real political upheaval and enormous contradictions between those governments and the United States, and how that plays out in terms of the oil crisis affecting the U.S.
Well, there's a lot going on all at once that ensures that this oil crisis is qualitatively different from those of the past, and this is much more long-lasting. And one of the qualitative differences is that we have used up over the past 30 years most of the remaining oil in the global north, in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, and other places that are near at hand and relatively under our control. Most of the world's remaining oil is in the global south, often in countries that were under imperial rule, that have been invaded in the past by the imperial powers of the United States, and they bear the legacies of colonialism and past invasions. And so there's a history of animosity. That's where most of the world's remaining oil is left. So it's not surprising that all of these countries, you could throw in Venezuela, Nigeria, Kazakhstan, have an inherent capacity for turmoil. And we're going to see one crisis after another for the remainder of the petroleum age. And that's going to produce continuing spikes in prices like we have today.
On the issue of oil and war, how does the Iraq war play into this, Michael Clare?
Well, It has a direct impact on Iraq because Iraq is the world's second largest owner of oil reserves. And if Iraq were a stable, functioning country, Iraq could be providing 3-4 times as much oil as it is today. Obviously, it's none of those things. It's a country ripped apart by war and internal conflict. And I can't imagine that's going to change anytime soon. So Iraq's potential oil is off the market. But on top of that, Iraq has become an engine for instability and chaos and competition throughout the entire region. And that makes everybody jittery, makes people worried about the possibility of more wars in the region. And that's probably the principal reason why oil prices are so high today. And on top of that, Amy, you have the lurking fear of U.S. airstrikes or who knows what against Iran looming over the horizon. And I think that's contributed to the higher prices of oil today.
Finally, in our next segment, we're going to talk more about the mortgage crisis. But the former CEO of Citibank, Charles Prince, resigned November 4th. The same day, Citi said it may write off this quarter $11 billion of assets linked to subprime mortgages. Your last comment, Professor Rubini, on the link between what's happening at not only Citibank, but with these banks and the mortgage crisis.
Certainly, we've had, you know, the most severe mortgage crisis in U.S. history. We had also a crisis in the 80s with the SNL boom and bust. This is a much bigger problem. You know, the amount of lending was done in the last few years to people who could not afford was a magnitude larger than this case. And therefore, now we're having the severe consequences of a bust and a worst housing recession in U.S. history. Home prices might fall as much as 20-25%. So, and that's going to be one of the important triggers of an economy-wide recession with large increases in unemployment rates. So that's the danger we're facing now.
Professor Rubini, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Nouriel Roubini is a professor of economics at NYU, former economic advisor to the Clinton administration, co-founder of the widely read Global Economic Monitor website. We'll link to his. And Michael Clare, professor at Hampshire College, has written many books, including Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Dependency on Imported Petroleum. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
The best thing in life is free. You can give it to the birds and bees. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yes, that's what I want. Your love give me such a thrill, but your love don't pay my bills. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yeah, that's what I want. Money don't get everything, is true. What it don't get, I can't use. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yes, that's what I want. A whole lot of money. Money don't get everything, that's true. What it don't get, I don't want. I need money. I need money. I need money.
John Lee Hooker is singing Money, That's What I Want here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
As we continue to discuss the economy, we turn now to look at some more at the subprime mortgage crisis and how it's affecting homeowners. The latest statistics show U.S. foreclosure filings nearly doubled in October from the same month last year. Nearly 225,000 foreclosure filings were reported last month, a 94% spike over October of 2006. And economists project the figures will only get worse in 2008 when some 2 million homeowners potentially face foreclosure when their adjustable rate mortgages reset at higher rates. African American and Latino homeowners have been particularly hard hit. A recent study by Acorn found that upper income African Americans and Latinos were more than three times as likely as upper income whites to have a high cost loan.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson has announced he plans to hold a march on Wall Street on December 10th to put pressure on corporations to address the needs of Americans who've been devastated by the foreclosure crisis. Meanwhile, Wednesday, a coalition of grassroots groups called on some of the nation's largest investment banks to donate their holiday bonuses to a foreclosure prevention fund that'll help prevent a new wave of foreclosures. The campaign's focusing on Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. Mark Winston Griffith joins us here in our Firehouse studio. He's co-director of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, or NEDAP, Community-Based Financial Justice and Advocacy Center. Lionel Ouellette is also with us. He's executive director of Changer, that organizes with homeowners caught up in the subprime crisis. Let's start with you, Mark.
Sure.
Talk about the situation on the ground.
Well, what we're seeing on the ground is what you've already described, that is, people are losing their homes at an epidemic rate. And we're seeing a discrepancy between what is happening to individuals and families and communities and sort of the response from government as well as the corporate bodies that were responsible for this mess in the first place. And so the demonstration that we had yesterday was really trying to call attention to the fact that Wall Street bears a great deal of responsibility for the foreclosure crisis and the subprime crisis that we face today, and that with responsibility comes accountability. And so the idea that the five largest investment firms should invest or donate, use whatever word you want to use, their money, put that money towards a rescue fund for homeowners facing foreclosure is a way to acknowledge this responsibility and accountability.
Mark, I remember when we talked, I guess it was in February of this year, when
sure.
I began writing a series of columns in the Daily News on the subprime crisis. And back then, people were saying, well, this is just the people who were the high credit risks, who were reckless in taking more loans than they could possibly afford to pay. It's not going to affect the rest of the market.
Right.
Now we're here like 7 months later, and it's an entire financial national crisis. The attempt initially by folks to stigmatize the borrowers as the problem. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think the problem is not individual. That is, it's not about individual borrowers. It's a structural problem. When you look at the fact that one out of four subprime loans is expected to go into foreclosure, that tells you that there's something wrong with the system, with the product, with the whole enterprise of subprime lending. And so something has to be done to change that, not the practices of individual borrowers, but the underwriting, the lending practices that have put these people in that position in the first place.
Lionel Ouellette, you organize homeowners. Tell us some of their stories.
One of our members, a Latina, first-time home buyer, 760 credit score, which should make her eligible for the best loan products out there, got a subprime 228, which is a loan that was fixed for 2 years, adjustable for 28. With a balloon payment, 760 credit score should have the best product available. She lives in an apartment and not even in the house because she can get an apartment cheaper and still have extra money to help pay the mortgage on the house that she owns. And she's hoping to refinance to do something before it adjusts in 2008.
Now, when you say 228, can you explain? And these interest rates jump phenomenally, right? Could
yes.
you talk the difference, what it means in terms of an actual payment suddenly after 2 years?
It can go from $2,300 up to $3,400 to $3,800 to $4,100. It can double.
$4,100 a month.
$4,100 a month, yeah.
And when you say a balloon payment,
balloon payment means that you pay in 5 years, 10 years, or 12 years, depending on the mortgage, you could have a payment of $180,000 to come due, or the entire balance of the loan.
Mark, tell us some of the stories of the people that you're organizing with.
Well, the thing about NEDAP is my organization is we work with a range of organizations that are engaging homeowners on a variety of levels. That is, foreclosure prevention in a lot of different ways through direct counseling, through legal remediation, through intervention with the lenders themselves. And so, you know, on a regular basis, we're hearing these stories of how people have essentially been duped into these very just shady loans, shady products. And, you know, it's coming from all ends. And so when I hear people talk about, you know, the personal responsibility of the borrower, it really sort of it gets us all upset because we know that, again, it's a structural problem.
And the other thing that you've also had several conferences or attended several conferences in terms of getting legislative action to help a lot of these homeowners. And I know Senator Schumer in New York and others have talked about finding some way to help people stay in their homes. But I'm surprised at how little has actually happened,
sure,
either at state levels or at the federal level, to move on a crisis that's almost like it's spreading so fast that it's if you don't act soon, it'll be almost impossible to prevent, you know, hundreds of thousands of people from being forced out of their homes.
Yeah. Lana.
When they found out that these toys that they were, I don't know if it was Disney toys, had lead paint, they didn't cut the price on them. They recalled them. These mortgages, it's this similar effect, and they're cutting the prices. Citigroup is writing down the bonds. Writing down the value of these assets that are backed by, you know, the families that we work with mortgages. And it's ridiculous because there's all these write-downs in terms of value, but then none of that is passed on. Like, okay, we realize that the bond's not worth as much. Well, that also translates the loan that you made. The house isn't worth as much, but there's none of that savings is going back to homeowners. One woman that I'm working with right now, another Latina first-time homebuyer, makes $36,000 a year as a dental assistant, and the mortgage broker falsified her income at $76,000 a year so that she'd be qualified for a loan that was made by a mortgage company, Long Beach Mortgage Company, that is a subsidiary of Washington Mutual, and you asked to bring up legislation. Washington Mutual is not responsible for what it bought.
So, keep going.
So, you know, without, and none of the legislation that is being passed contains that element. They call it assignee liability. There's no sort of responsibility for the people that buy these predatory loans, these subprime loans.
And can I just add that, you know, here we are almost in December, and we've been talking about this problem now for what? At least 9 months. And it's remarkable how little has happened on a federal, state, and in New York on a city level to address this problem.
Did you see the map in the New York Times of where these, where what you call these products are concentrated in New York City? Can you describe that for us?
Well, we make maps ourselves. That's what NEDAP, that's one of the things that we do. And for years, we've had these maps that show that where subprime loans, in fact, you know, their maps are being shown right now, where subprime loans are being made and where foreclosures are occurring are all concentrated in neighborhoods of color. So wherever you find a neighborhood of color and a high degree of home ownership, you will see foreclosures and you will see a high incidence of subprime lending.
Nearly none in Manhattan.
Nearly none in Manhattan. Well, right. There's not many homeowners in Manhattan as well.
Explain fixed rate to adjustable, what that means.
Well, a fixed rate loan depends on the term. Like most people want, when they say fixed rate, they think that they're getting they're going to have the same payment every month for the total length of the 30 years of their mortgage. Adjustable rate means that the rate of your mortgage will go up based on an index. And usually most loans in the United States are based on LIBOR, which is an index in London. But what was happening was people would say, I'm getting a fixed rate loan. And the mortgage broker said, yeah, it's fixed. It's fixed for 2 years. And they kind of whisper the 2-year part or don't even say that. And so people You know, people were, it's a housing crisis. We've always had a housing crisis, especially for people of color, low-income and working-class folks in the city, across the country. And so people are in desperate need for housing, and somebody comes along and says, oh, no problem, you make this amount of money, it's going to cost you $1,200 a month, you can do it. And in that search for housing, they get caught up in these loan products.
The other thing that you raise is the question of I'd like to get a little more into the question of liability, the assigning of who's responsible for this, because many people aren't aware what happens to a mortgage once it is actually once a loan is actually made. Usually you've got a broker and a real estate lender and often an appraiser, because part of the problem is that in order to produce a large loan, you've got to get an appraiser who's going to say this house is worth this much money. And one of the things that's happened now is it's become clear that many appraisers were overvaluing properties. So the original loan was far greater than the house was worth. Then you have an interest rate that makes it difficult for the homeowner to buy. But then that loan gets sold to another mortgage company, which then collateralizes it in a huge bunch of similar risky loans, sure. And then it appears on Wall Street, sure. as a bond issue, right? So that, sure. Everyone is passing the bad loan on to someone else, right. And no one is assuming responsibility, right. For having participated in this, right. Inflated value that continues to be passed on from one person to another.
Right, and in the old days, you used to know. You know, there used to be a direct relationship between the borrower and the lender.
And now, it was usually a bank.
Usually a bank. And now there are all these middle people with, you know, whose sort of prime directive is to sort of obfuscate who's actually holding the loan. And so when you're the borrower, there are, you know, there's the originator, there's the servicer, there are all these other people who are involved. And again, that's where it becomes very difficult to assign responsibility, and if you're the victim of fraud, to actually get some compensation for that, because essentially all that responsibility and liability has been just spread out over a series of people to the extent that it almost doesn't exist.
Yes, Lionel.
Well, the issue of the overappraisals, Washington Mutual is being investigated by the Attorney General in New York State right now in regards to their. And it was, they dug up emails, and they found emails where Washington Mutual was like, no, we want these appraisers and this company to handle it, because we're not happy with how some of the appraisers are handling it. And so this is like one, it's a great case, because it points to one of the largest, I think Washington Mutual is the largest savings and loan in the country, and how they're linked to this. And it doesn't, unfortunately, the overappraisal results in overfinancing and just in huge debt loads in communities. And that's destructive to a community. As you know, and not people would say, oh, you're rising housing prices are good. Well, it's not good if your debt load is in line with that. And there's just not enough resources going to really help people keep their homes.
Mark Winston Griffith, mm-hmm. The march on December 10th, Jesse Jackson leading on Wall Street. Dealing with Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. Have any of these large financial institutions responded in a way you consider favorable? Are there any positive examples here?
Well, our demonstration just occurred yesterday, and we went to Goldman Sachs actually to deliver the letter, and we literally couldn't get through the front door. So, no, I have not seen a response that I would consider favorable yet. I will give them the benefit of the doubt and say that there's still some time for them to respond. But up to now, you know, that's really what was the instigation for us to do this in the first place, is that Wall Street has not only been silent, but just has claimed no kind of responsibility, and we want to address that.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Mark Winston Griffith is the co-director of NEDAP, the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, which is a community-based financial justice group. We've also been joined by Lionel Willett, who is the executive director of Changer, organizing among homeowners caught in the subprime crisis. Thanks for joining us. We'll
Thank
link
you.
To your websites as well, and as well as Juan's groundbreaking series of columns that he did in the New York Daily News. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. Happy birthday, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.